Tucker.
The S&P.
The ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that hopes not to join the unemployment queue anytime soon. I'm Scott Phillips and with me is Dr. Anirban Mahanti. G'day, Doc.
Good day, Scott. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you, mate. It's a good day to record a podcast. And today we are going to cover the big picture, a little bit on unemployment and US interest rates. But trust us, it's worth listening to. Also, retail shenanigans, Kogan and Godfrey's two end of the retail story. Also, the story of a mining company being bought not for its mine, but for its infrastructure. We'll finish off with a mailbag. And if we have time, my turn to get on the high, high horse. All right, Doc, let's kick off with the big picture. Mate, there's been a little bit of kind of macro news and data out this week, in particular in Australia, the unemployment numbers. And in the US, we've had the US Fed rate go up for, I want to say, the seventh time since the lows of the post-GFC period. Let's start with unemployment, though. The rate came down from 5.6 to 5.4. The market kind of shrugged its shoulders and was almost a bit disappointed. Tell us why.
Well, so 5.4 is a good low unemployment
number. You would
number.
Have thought so.
Oh, I think it's...
Should have been a party, surely.
Should have been a party, but there are a couple of things. If you look, I guess, below the surface here. Number one was the total number of jobs created in the economy was about 12,000.
That's good.
And that's a good number. But the makeup of that was about 32,600 jobs created in the part-time sector.
Right.
Which was offset by a drop in full-time employment of 20,600. Okay. So we created more part-time jobs than full-time jobs.
Right.
So people were not happy about that, maybe.
But still the unemployment rate went down. That's still got to be a positive somewhere, right?
It's still a positive. I mean, you know, people complain about different things. Another another complaint I heard was, there's some sort of underutilization, I guess, of people who want employment.
Right.
So the point is that people have part-time employment. And if you ask them whether they want more hours, then they say yes. And the underutilization rate is those people who essentially are saying they want more hours but didn't get it.
Underemployment. Okay, cool.
Underutilization.
Makes sense.
And that's around 14%, but that's around what has typically been for a while.
Yeah. So interesting, too. We saw the participation rate fall by 0.2%, which was exactly the same as the unemployment rate drop. So that explains almost the entire fall. And it's kind of a funny thing. The participation rate, I don't know. I have a usual complaint. I think economists are way too negative about the economy. I'd be keen on your thoughts. I think to some degree, when the participation rate goes up, no one celebrates. When the unemployment rate holds steady, but it's steady because we created more jobs and more people wanted a job. In other words, the unemployment rate stayed the same, but we created a lot of jobs. There's not much celebration. And yet when there's a drop in the participation rate, people kind of get a bit miserable. It kind of feels like the glass is half empty either way.
So my thought on this is, you know, it sounds smarter to be bearish.
Yeah, I think that's true. Pessimism always sounds smarter, right?
Yeah, pessimism sounds smarter. And that's really what it is, I think, that, you know, people really talk up the things that, you know, did not hit the mark, but, you know, forget about things that actually hit the mark and, you know, we are doing well. I mean, again, nothing to, you know, 5.4% is a very, very good number.
We're optimists. We'll stick with that. Mate, exactly. Let me go across the big pond, across to the US. You're a keen student of US markets in particular. And this week we saw the US federal funds rate, their version of the RBA cash rate, increase by another 25 basis points or 0.25%.
Mm-hmm.
This is the seventh rise, I want to say, since the lows. And they're saying there might be more to come. What happened and what's coming next?
Right. So the U.S. Federal Reserve, which is essentially the RBA equivalent in the U.S., they raised the rate by, as you said, 0.25%. And they have what's called essentially a floating rate. So that, now the bank rate has been set to essentially between 1.75% and 2%.
Right.
And they, their policy board, when they meet, they basically provide what's essentially a forecast of what's going to happen or what they think is likely to happen. they had been penciling 3 rate rises this year. Now they're saying, well, there's going to be 4 rate rises, which means 2 more to come.
Instead of one more, which means
2 more quarter basis point raises. And they are projecting to sort of end 2020 with a rate somewhere around 3.25 to 3.5%.
Now, that's almost double the Australian rate.
Exactly. And that's the interesting part. Our cash rate is 1.5%. Their cash rate now is 1.75% to 2%. This has happened, I think, the first time in now, 15 years?
Yeah, it might be even longer. I think it might be 20 years almost. Yeah.
And the headline on AFR is interesting. It says that a Fed hike puts squeeze on the banks.
Now, this this is where it gets real, right? Because what happens in the US is kind of interesting and it kind of feels theoretical and over there. And so we don't tend to worry too much about it. But there is a real Australian impact.
Yes. So the impact is that, you know, if 50% or so of our funds that, you know, the money that people borrow have mm-hmm. to be raised overseas and the overseas rate go up,
yep.
it basically means that the banks have to pay more to raise money.
Right. So let's break that down. If you think about when you take out a loan from the bank, around half of your loan is funded by Australian people putting money into savings accounts, term deposits, bank products that kind of put money away. They re-lend it. That's their core business.
Mm-hmm.
But these days, and probably for the last 20 or so years, the banks have got large amounts of money from the overseas, what they call the wholesale funding market. In other words, half of what, you know, if I take out a mortgage today for $500,000, about half of that will come from Australian depositors. The other half, they go overseas and say, hey, can we borrow some money from a wholesale debt market in the US? They put that together with the money from here, give me that loan. And then by definition, their funding cost is kind of half set by the Australian deposit rates
yep.
and half set by that wholesale funding rate.
Absolutely.
And your point is if we see US rates go up, then the average mix of the interest rate the bank's got to charge me must either go up or the bank's going to make less money. But you kind of can't have it. There's no third option,
right? Yeah, there's no really third options in, you know, and the banks would like to make more money or at least keep making the same amount of money.
And their shareholders would very much appreciate
and
that
too. And that's what the bank shareholders would want. And that's how you're going to keep those dividends and the franking credits coming with the dividends. So, yeah. So this basically means that, you know, the rates essentially have to go up should go up, yep. theoretically speaking.
Nothing is definite.
Exactly. There's no guarantees to anything.
Right.
Yeah. So it basically means that we would likely see rate increases being passed through, even if RBA doesn't do anything.
I think it's a really good point. We might have made this point before, but I think that's important. We focus so much on the RBA and what they're doing for rates, and the average retail investor, the average mortgage holder, looks at the RBA rate and tries to kind of say, well, okay, RBA's not going to lift rates, therefore my rate's not going to go up. But it's only really half of the story. We really don't focus too much on that. We haven't had to over the last 20 years.
Yep.
But as you say, this is the first time in a couple of decades we've seen that. The Australian rate is actually lower than US rates and probably likely to remain so really for a decently long time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, combine that with other stuff that we have talked about last time, you know, housing market and
so on. Oh, come on. No, enough about housing.
Okay, fine. We'll not talk about housing.
maybe next week. Hold your horse on that. We'll see how we go.
I'll hold off.
there is a connection, though, to our next story.
Motley Fool Money. For more, go to fool.com.au/MMM.
We want to talk about the retail space. We want to particularly talk about, on one hand, Kogan, the kind of the enfant terrible, if you like, the upstart, the Amazon wannabe, the company's growing at leaps and bounds. On the other hand, there's poor old Godfrey's. Now, let's start with Kogan. So we talked last week a little bit about the fact that Kogan's founder and CFO, so Ruslan Kogan and the CFO, whose name I forget, were looking to sell their shares. Now, they say they didn't sell the shares, they didn't get an offer they wanted. All went quiet until, was it Tuesday or Wednesday this week?
Mm. Okay. So you don't really like vacuum cleaners, do you? I mean, that's what you
both think. I prefer not to use a vacuum cleaner if I don't have to, but I unfortunately find myself having to on a regular basis. I have a 5-year-old, so these things are semi-regular occurrences, unfortunately.
Okay. I'll go back to Kogan.
Tell me about Kogan first.
So on June 5th, Ruslan Kogan and David Sheffer, the CFO, they basically told the market that they didn't receive kind of bid that they would like to sell the stock, which basically means that they didn't get the price that they wanted. The price was above $9, I think, the day before.
The share price,
Share price. Then on June 13th.
Just a week later?
No, it's a week later.
Yep.
They announced that they received an unsolicited bid. Okay, that's a key point, unsolicited.
Right.
Bid for 6 million shares.
In other words, they didn't go and look for it. Hello, this is Ruslan Kogan speaking. Ruslan, I'd like to buy 6 million shares, please.
Exactly.
Okay,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Or somebody just knocked on his door, you know, on his new shiny house. And they said, they're happy to buy 6 million shares. And they reluctantly sold shares.
Now, I'd love to reluctantly have a $50 million problem, Doc. I've got to say, if someone offered me a $50 million, I'd reluctantly accept, I think.
But there's one point I want to make here.
All right.
On the 13th, on the 12th, mm-hmm. the share price was around $7.80, which means somebody paid less. And if they did not accept the bid on the prior instance, when the share price was higher, which means, you know, they basically reluctantly accepted a lower price.
Mm.
This is just my guess. We haven't seen the director's change of ownership being lodged yet, so we don't know, but that's my guess.
In fact, breaking news, Matt, it came out about 10 minutes ago. So we've just had it hit the wires. Interestingly enough, too, I will say that part of that announcement said they have reluctantly accepted the bid due to personal financial commitments.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing like a forced seller if you want to buy shares on the cheap, right? You can pretty much say, well, I know you need to sell, so here's an offer. Take it or leave it. It sounds a little bit to me like they needed the money.
Mm.
They sold as few shares as they needed to effectively get the money they wanted to get it across the line. And as you say, the fact they waited an extra couple of days or a week cost them, that's the best part of what, $5 million, I suppose?
Well, something like that, a few Ferraris. Jeez. Or something like that.
That's an expensive week, right?
Very expensive.
There's very little else you can do in a week that's going to cost you $5 million, but they manage it. Now, despite that, I still like Kogan very much. What's your thought on Kogan, mate? Do you like it? Do you hate it? What's your view?
Well, I really like online retail.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way to go in retail. So I like Kogan for that reason. I don't have a view on the valuation, but I think it's a good company with a good strategy. So I actually like the company.
Now, from the sublime to the unfortunately really badly struggling, Godfrey's was out this week. Their fourth profit downgrade in 12 months. And they've said that they're going to earn between zero and $1.5 million. Now, in the background, we have the co-founder, who I think we want to say co-founded in 1950, I want to say. The guy's 90.
99.
He's going to buy 99. Is he that old?
Something
like that. There you go. 90-something. Yeah. We'll split the difference, call it 95-ish.
Okay.
I'm sure he doesn't mind either way. He'd be happy to take a couple of years off. He's going to buy the company. He owns 82 or 83% of it now. He's hoping to buy the rest. This is kind of he's hoping to buy it to, I read it in the paper a couple of days ago, basically to kind of try and salvage something of the family fortune.
Mm-hmm.
He may see this as kind of a last roll of the dice. What is going on with Godfrey's?
Oh, so this looks like I'd use the word basket case.
That's a technical term, fools. If you're listening, you won't find that in the economics textbooks, but trust us, basket case is a thing.
This is pretty, it's taken a turn for the worse, as you said.
Does it suck?
Vacuum cleaner sucks. Sucks.
Bad. We need a boom tish lamb if you can find me on it. My jokes aren't so good without some sort of sound effect. An audience laughter or something would be nice if you could, mate. Help us out. Jeez.
I'll just add, on May 9th, the company said that they are looking to make about $3.5 million. Right,
so a month ago this year. Let's put it in context. Not that. Four lonely weeks ago.
Four lonely weeks ago, the company advised the market that they're going to make about $3.5 million of operating profit.
Everyone's happy.
Okay, not bad. Now, when the new management has taken over, they figure, well, that's going to be between zero and $1.5 million. That is, brutal.
Add
to the mix, same-store sales, or like-for-like sales. So when you compare the sales this year with the year ago across the same store set, that has fallen a brutal 8.5%. Okay. And brick and mortar retail is hard.
Right.
And it's really tough. And that's because, you've got a fixed cost base, right? And I mean, if you don't make enough money coming through, you've got a fixed, large-ish cost base, you're in trouble.
Right.
Right. And that 8.5% drop is really big. I mean, that's a big number.
If you lost 8.8% of your stadium crowd, not a big deal, right? You lose 8% of your retail sales.
Mm.
That pretty much wipes out your entire profit margin, which is exactly what we're seeing from Godfrey's. Exactly. Just for reference, this was a $3.60 stock.
How much
back
is it
in
now?
March 2015. Fast forward 3 years, it's now 33 cents. That's a 90% value destruction, and no better word than destruction for that, in the space of only 3 years. Hopefully, for the guy's sake, he can make some money out of this. Hopefully, he can get fixed and turned around. It did massively miss the move towards stick vacuums. I think we might have talked about this before as well. It just entirely missed it. Complete whiff. The future is in stick vacuums. In fact, even Dyson is not going to make any of the usual kind of pull behind what they call barrel vacuums anymore. It's all about the stick vacuum. Well, Godfrey's is way, way, way behind the game, whether it can catch up or not. The good old days, they used to say cleanliness is next to godfreyness. Do you remember the ad? It was the guy with the vacuum and the bowling ball. I hope that's not going to be just an article of the past. Hopefully they can turn this thing around. I'm not particularly hopeful, I've got to say. It's a long bow to draw, given, as you've already said, the growth of online retail and the response of the category killers like the Harvey Normans and JB Hi-Fis, who are trying to get whatever business they can. Godfrey's feels like the kind of third place loser in retail. You can't afford to be in that spot, right?
Does Kogan sell Kogan branded vacuum cleaners?
If it doesn't, I'm sure it will very soon.
I bet that's the next one.
Indeed.
Real money advice from real people. Not just a couple of dicks with a Porsche. Get more at fool.com.au/MMM.
Now, buying a mining company, you think about the reasons you could buy a mining company, Doc, and you buy it for maybe the ore, you might buy it for the price, you might want to speculate on what else you can find. There's a million reasons to do it. It turned out this week that Atlas Iron, the kind of the minor, if you like, the smaller miner of the group, it's had some really high cost or it's almost gone broke in the past. At the moment, it's kind of subject to a bit of a three-way tussle for control. There's bidding parties, including Fortescue Mines, including Jenna Reinhart's Hancock Prospecting and one other overseas player, who are all trying to buy Atlas Iron. Mm. And yet the share price fell during the week, not because of anything they found or didn't find, not because of the movements in iron ore or other prices. Why did the share price fall this way?
That's a good one. So the third party in the mix was a mineral resources, a company called Mineral Resources.
That's right.
So they're all interested in the junior miner, not for the, as you said, not for the mine, not for whatever they're mining. They all want a piece of the capacity, loading capacity at Port Hedland.
So you're going to buy a mining company.
That's the
so you can access the port.
So that you can access the port because they have a deal or they have exclusive rights to certain parts of the port or certain, you know, certain capacity at the port.
Right.
But the shares fell because the WA government came out and said, well, we are giving out this capacity to junior miners.
Right.
And you guys who are bidding, you're probably not junior miners.
Okay, so, but even then, let me just go back to it. How is it possible that an entire mining company is worth more, or at least a large part of its value, for port access rather than the actual mine itself?
Oh, maybe port access is limited, right? I mean, you know, that's government controlled. It's an infrastructure which the government controls. You have a critical asset, and the critical asset is tied with this junior mining company, and everybody wants a piece of that asset.
Yeah, I think it's a funny conversation, right? See, if you think about iron ore miners, it's often been joked, and probably like all jokes, there's a kernel of truth to it, maybe more than a kernel in this case, that an iron ore miner is largely an infrastructure company with a mine at the end. In other words, it's all about the transport. You think about something that sells for $40 a ton. So imagine a ton of dirt, and then say you only get $40 for that, and you get $40 for that when you drop it in China. And now you think about where's the value creation, or what's the difference between a good and a bad operation? If you're a miner, you can't control the price. You can't control the volume, except that, you know, hopefully China will want more. So how do you create some sort of cost competitive outcome? And the answer is you've basically got to be able to get it to the customer as cheaply as you possibly can. And this is where rail lines and ports come in super handy. If you have an iron ore mine, it doesn't even matter how much iron ore you have or even how easy it is to get off the ground. If you can't get it to the customer cheaply, the mine's useless. At that sort of price, at $400 a ton, there's a very, very different story. And we saw when the iron ore price spiked to 130, 140 bucks a ton a few years back, anyone could mine iron ore and make a fortune. But it's just incredibly, incredibly tough. The costs that someone like a Fortescue get the ore out of the ground for is like 14, 15 bucks a ton. And that's delivered to the customer. If you just, you try and visualize a ton of dirt, imagine that's worth $14. You know, you pay $14 for two coffees in the Sydney CBD these days. And so that's kind of that's the big story. That's why the ports are so valuable, is that Fortescue and Mineral Resources and Hancock would love that port access, not even for Atlas's own ore, but for the ore themselves. They want to get out of the ground. If they can find a closer, cheaper, easier route, if they can get more effectively capacity out of those ports, that's where the real value was. And it's an interesting lesson for investors, because there's often opportunities where you might look at a company and say, well, Atlas Iron, do I like it or not like it? And you start down the path of, well, it's a miner, it's got this cost, it's run this well, here's the price. And it turns out that most of the value that the other people see in Atlas is not for that at all. And there's often other investments where there's kind of hidden value, right? There's parts of those businesses that maybe you don't necessarily see. And if you're an enterprising investor and you want to do a little bit of digging, you can often find some good opportunities.
Value stocks.
Market.
Stock market.
Index.
Share market.
This is Motley Fool Money. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Now, I want to move on to, before we do, I want to, there's an example of that kind of hidden value. And it's one of the biggest and best companies on the planet, at least in my view. I reckon you might be able to tell me, despite the fact that you've taken the other side of this bet last week. Give me a very high-profile example of a company that maybe starts with A. It may have an M and an A and a Z and O and an
A. You just want me to talk about your bet. Well, okay.
No, you have to talk about the bet. But Amazon is a really, really key example of some hidden value, or at least some business that's not as well understood from the outside as maybe some people would believe.
So Amazon was, for the longest time, regarded as the online retailer, right?
Still is.
And it still is. The biggest online retailer.
The biggest and best, yes, exactly.
The biggest and best. I own the stock too.
There you go, good man.
I have no problem with that.
Good man. We both own it, so let's disclose that.
So that's good. But for the longest time, they did not disclose how much money they were making off Amazon Web Services.
Now, most people maybe most people do by now, but for a very long time, most people didn't even know what AWS was, let alone that it was of any value. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I think it was in the tech community, people knew about it because every tech developer was using it. Right, but then those numbers were not discussed. There were rumors around, and maybe it's a Fortune 100 company or.
Just take a step back. What is Amazon Web Services? Just for those who don't necessarily know.
So people who want to host services on the cloud, mm-hmm. you want to run your entire IT infrastructure on the cloud. You can actually do it on Amazon Web Services.
So effectively, rather than having servers in the back room of an office somewhere mm-hmm. in a retail shop or a commercial office or something else, you're contracting out that storage and access kind of process to the cloud, and Amazon's one of the big hosters of all that, both the computing services and the storage services, right?
Yeah. So computing services, storage services, lots of other things, database. You can run databases on the cloud.
Right.
Pretty much everything.
And a cool story, Amazon it might be apocryphal, but I'm pretty sure it's true. Mm. It kind of was born because Bezos realized there was kind of latent capacity in its servers at different times. Mm. Is that true?
I don't know whether this is a real story or not. This is what I've heard too.
That makes a good story.
It just makes a good story. So the story goes like this, that every time, essentially they, during Christmas time, mm-hmm. they had a huge, significant surge in demand for serving their customers.
Everyone's on the site. Everyone wants to buy stuff.
Exactly. And therefore, to provision for Christmas time, they had to build all these internal resources and, build a scalable system that scales up during Christmas time. The issue then was that after Christmas, they need all the spare resources that they had created. So the story goes that they basically decided that, we can make some money off this. Well, that's the story, I guess.
And normally, so that's interesting because as I'm listening to you talking, the answer was, why don't you get some storage from the cloud? And the reality was that didn't exist. That's exactly why AWS started. They had to originally provision themselves. They couldn't just outsource that to the cloud. They had to say, there is no one doing this. We'll buy more computers. We'll buy more servers. And I'll use the layman's version. You'd have a much better technical explanation. We'll buy lots of computers. We'll put them in the back rooms when we need them. That's the very birth of this kind of idea is they couldn't use the cloud service. It didn't exist, but their capacity kind of peaks and troughs created the opportunity for AWS itself.
You spin up resources when you need them. You spin them down when you don't need them.
So you sound much more technically apt than me. Spin up and spin down is I'm going to have to put that into my... I'm going to spin up a new topic for us now.
All right.
How about that?
Well, that sounds pretty cool. Let's do that.
All right. We had one email a tweet from a listener during the week from John. And John says, how important is it to watch the PE weightings within your portfolio? And John attaches a chart where there's a whole lot of kind of high PE stocks in green, and there's a whole lot in red of low PE stocks. Mm-hmm. And he says, look, I've got stocks all in the green, none in the red. That kind of, should I be worried about that? How important is the PE when it comes to thinking about what's in your portfolio, how much you should hold? How do you think about, or how should our listeners think about high PEs, low PEs inside their portfolio?
Okay. I'll take the first stab, and I'm sure you'll have a view on this.
because I'm an arrogant so-and-so and I've got an opinion on everything?
You just have an opinion on everything.
Hey, that's what I'm paid for. That's what we're doing here.
Okay. So the PE is basically the share price divided by earnings per share.
Excellent.
You take the total earnings and divide it by the total number of share count, you get the earnings per share.
Nice.
Now, that by itself tells you pretty much nothing.
Well, hang on.
It tells you something.
If I've got a stock on a PE of 14, so it's 14 times earnings, one on 30 times earnings, surely the one on 14 times earnings is cheaper than the one on 30. That's got to be that much at least.
It doesn't, because what it does not tell you is what is earnings growth rate. If you have earnings growing at 100% versus earnings growing at like minus 5%, would you pay 14 times earnings for a minus 5% growing company?
Right.
So that, I think that's what's missing. First is the fact that you're missing completely the growth rates from the equation.
Okay.
Right. Most of the time, what you'd see is the companies that have the very high PEs are also the ones that are growing really fast.
Right.
The other thing that you're missing from the equation is what about the company's investment for future earnings, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. It's all about the future.
Yes.
Right? And
you can't buy last year's profits, you only get next year's.
Exactly.
Yep.
So if you're investing for the future, then you might actually see the E shrink, the earnings shrink, because it's going into some sort of CapEx, some development work, R&D, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You're going to make that money off in the future. In the artificial intelligence world of the future, those people who are investing today are going to make the money tomorrow. Or day after, next year, and so on. So I think those things are missing, and that's, I think you can't just look at the PE. I had a cursory look at that list, and it looked to me that the companies on the green are the, what I would call the this generation's company or the next generation company,
right.
in the red look like the ones that are from the last generation or the last, you know, maybe.
Let's not have generation wars here on the podcast. So I think it's a really good point. I think, as you say, you have to, every PE, if the market's working even slightly efficiently, the PE, yes, it's expressed in today's price versus last year's earnings, but that kind of doesn't matter other than as an indication of a base for the future growth. And as investors, and particularly as, well, investors by definition should be long-term, as our co-founder and chief rule breaker, David Gardner, likes to say. But to that extent, if we are going to be long-term in our approach, we really don't care about this month's earnings, even this year's earnings, but a few years down the track. And as you say, if I was going to buy a business today and I thought that business was going to generate a whole lot of profit in 3 years' time, it's kind of that number that matters, right? Because that's the money I get, rather than worry about what happened last year. Either way, and I think that's part of it. Is it not fair to say, though, mate, that so you're let me assume that what you're saying about next generation's company versus last generation is that you're saying that these are going to be the dominant players of the future, and so are justified in having higher PEs because they're the growth businesses, and the kind of last generation's companies are on their, if not deathbed, they're kind of on the way out. They're not going to do much, and so they should have lower PEs.
Yeah.
What about the context of, say, let's go with the dot-com bubble in 1999, or let's go with the GFC kind of maximum pessimism in 2008, 2009.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't there a possibility that the market's just, that the PEs are expressing the market's sentiment rather than actual likely futures? In other words, if I was to take, I would speculate that a quarter of the growing companies, a quarter of the ones with high PEs and a quarter of the ones with low PEs, the ones with the high PEs, a quarter of them are probably going to go badly, and a quarter of the ones with low PEs are probably going to go well, just because there's every chance that sentiment is having more of an impact on the share price than the actual business itself.
Right. So I mean, I think that's a valid point. I think the main thing is that if you're thinking about, if you're in, say, in a 2008, like, you know, recessionary environment, and this, all the stocks have been pummeled.
Right.
Well, then you can look at the PE and look at, say, historic PE and compare it with the current PE and say, well, you know, this really looks cheap and I should buy it. Right. So yeah, there's some amount of sentiment involved, and you know, when the sentiment goes sour, everything falls, and maybe the growth companies fall more. So again, to me, it's a very relative thing. I think I try to look at it more from a relative point of view. Maybe so, you look at the, let's say, the ASX 200 has a certain expected growth rate and has a certain PE. If I'm buying something with a higher PE, then I do expect it to grow at a faster rate, right?
Right.
And as long as it does that, I think I'm fine.
Yeah.
Right.
But there are some high PE stocks that actually won't do that, right? I guess that's my point. Is that we shouldn't assume just because they're high PEs, they're all going to be successful.
Yeah.
The market still gets these things wrong. I use the counterexample, Berkshire Hathaway, one of my favorites, as you well know, Doc. Warren Buffett's company. Back in 2007, it was trading these numbers are bizarre, right? But stick with us, listeners. $143,000 a share for Berkshire in December 2007.
Mm-hmm.
Only less than 18 months later, they were changing hands for under $80,000 a share.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in the very midst of the dot-com boom. And I think there's some sense, and I think, you know, I completely agree with you for what it's worth, and I should say that. But also, those with low PEs, yes, maybe they are yesterday's stocks, and maybe they're destined for mediocrity. But maybe, just maybe, some of those are being oversold because the market's looking in the wrong direction. And so to some degree, you know, was Berkshire really worth half the value 18 months later that happened to coincide with everyone embracing the dot-com heroes? I don't think that was necessarily the case. And we do see sentiment can swing too wildly in both directions. Very probably, a lot of those high PE companies are going to go on to be very, very successful, but some won't. And equally, a lot of those low PE companies will and do justify a very low PE because they are, if not awful companies, at least relatively ordinary. But you can find opportunity in both of those slots if you look carefully at what the business is. And is the market really reflecting the true reality, or is it just getting a bit carried away with the sentiment of a particular industry or company or time in the market?
No, I completely agree with that. I mean, you can, you know, even, you know, cigar butts can be useful, right?
You got it. So, you got it.
Yeah. Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Liam, release the horses. That's right. We almost didn't have enough time, but luckily I can make this thing stretch just a little bit further to take our favourite nag for one lap around the track. I'm going to rant about the Australian dollar, Doc, and I'd be keen if you have some thoughts as we talk about this. It drives me bananas. People look at the Australian dollar and cheerlead it as though it's a thing that has inherent underlying value. When the dollar's up, we say, oh, it's great, the dollar's up. And when the dollar falls, we're like, oh, it's terrible, the dollar's falling. Isn't that awful? Oh, down it goes. And somehow we get some sort of sense of A, national pride, and B, even investment approach from the sense that a higher dollar must be good because, hey, it's higher, and a lower dollar must be bad because, hey, it's lower. And it just makes me absolutely bananas. There is a real lack, even among serious economists, there's this sense that somehow it's a national pride score or it's some sort of national success score. And if it's not over a certain amount, if it's not going up, then that must be a terrible thing. And we say that when we talk about the news coverage, we talk about the economics coverage, there is this real sense that a higher dollar must be better and a lower dollar must be worse. And it drives me bananas because if you think about it logically, unless you're an importer and unless you're going overseas, a lower dollar is actually a net positive for Australia, which is an exporting country. We export tourism, we export education, we export manufacturers, we export primary goods like wool and wheat, and by the way, iron ore and gold. It drives me bananas. It really makes me grumpy. Now, if we invest overseas, that obviously changes how much money we get for our Australian dollars when we do it. But I don't understand why people persist in pretending that somehow this is a score of national well-being or some ridiculous. It's almost the kind of, you know, like we're making up for something by having this Australian dollar as our kind of hero metric. Between that and Commonwealth Games gold medals, it's kind of how we see ourselves in the world. Am I completely wrong, or is this fascination, this obsession with a higher dollar really leading us up the garden path?
Well, I think you're not completely wrong, although I'll say that.
I'll take that.
You want to be correct.
We all like to be right.
Right, yeah.
Plus, I am most of the time, so that helps.
Well, that's true. How can I disagree?
you're welcome to disagree if you want, mate. Just don't expect to check next week for your
Yeah, pay. Exactly. That's why I'm not disagreeing. You're always right, and you're always
come
correct.
On. Give me the counter.
Okay. So, I don't have a counter in the sense that I actually agree with you. The disadvantages are, I guess, as our dollar becomes less powerful, mm-hmm. then our, you know, when we are importing things, we are paying more, which yes. effectively translates into us paying more. So if we are importing cars,
sure.
televisions, whatever else we are importing.
Computers,
yep. all the yep. consumption costs yep. more. And, you know, Australians love going on holidays. I love going on holidays. And I really don't like paying more for steak when I go overseas.
I would say, on behalf of the Australian beef farmers, you should stay in Australia, find your local restaurant, have a lovely steak beef dinner at a local place near you.
I have nothing against local farmers and I love the local steak, but when I go overseas, I also want to have the steak.
Fair enough.
And you know, the air turbine fuel goes up. But as you said, for an export economy, it's an advantage. There's also some equation here, and I might not get this 100% right, but I think the inflow of money from mm-hmm. overseas also decreases mm-hmm. to some extent.
Correct, yeah.
And that has impact on, I guess, investments. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's not something that we should be completely, we can't have a black and white view on it.
Right, it goes both ways. And we should say, to your point about paying more for steak overseas and the price of jet fuel, it also increases things like petrol costs. And that's a real part of people's household yeah. budgets, isn't it? It's not painless and it's not worth nothing. But sometimes, to some degree, and this is where the RBA have for the last couple of years been desperately waiting for the US to increase rates for exactly that reason. If it pushes the dollar down, it makes our exports much more competitive. Yeah. And it really is think about the unemployment number we talked about earlier. Think about wages. When you add economic stimulus to a local economy, you are going to create jobs. You are going to create profits. You are going to create, hopefully, for the market, for all of us listening, wage inflation. We'd all like to be paid a little bit
exactly.
more. You mentioned that to me every now and again, Doc, and I always try and listen to that and then ignore it. So I think, you know, to some degree, I get there are no clear, well, there's not a lack of losers when someone wins, but I do think that frankly, if it was up to me, I would prefer a lower Australian dollar. I think we'd be much better off as a country with a lower dollar than a higher one, particularly as things struggle to really take off in terms of economic growth in the country.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that makes sense.
Mate, if you agree with me is a great way to finish the podcast, so we will.
Just give me the raise.
We got to close. No time.
Oh, come on.
All right, that wraps us up. But before we go, don't forget you can subscribe, and you should, to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast through iTunes, that's Doc's favourite, or your favourite Android podcast app, which is mine. And if you like what we're doing, please give us a big 5-star rating on iTunes and tell your friends. I'm sure they could do with a little foolish straight talk too. That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll be back next week with another round of Foolish Insight. Fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.